Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Fake TV Critic, a podcast where I discuss the week's biggest TV news headlines, recap and analyze some of my favorite shows, and let you know what you should be watching. Apologies for being a little late this week. I do have jobs and shit, and, you know, shit happens. But in news, strike is still going on. Talks broke down this week between SAG, the Actors Guild, and the MPTP, which is the producers. Unfortunately for the actors, the Producers Guild, the AMPTP, got their version out first. So after talks broke down, I guess on like Wednesday, I think, of last week, the producers immediately issued a condemnation of the Actors Guild. And they basically said that there was, that what the actors were asking for was absurd and would never be able to actually come to a conclusion if that of the strike, if that's what they were asking for. And what they were asking for is about 2% of profits from streaming, streaming TV shows in particular. And the studio that and the CEOs and the studios that are leading these talks say that that equals out to more than $800 million per year to then be distributed amongst the Actors Guild, and that that is untenable, basically, for them, that they can't meet that demand because that it's too much of their profits. Now, to that, I say, are you fucking kidding me? They're not asking for 2% regardless. They're asking for 2% of profits. That means that anything that you make above what you've already spent, right? 2% of that. So why can't they give out $800 million if it's, or why can't they give out 2% of profits? You know, these are actors. They know how this shit works. They know that if the profits are lower, so is their return going to be lower. They're not asking for 2%, period. You know, if a studio is losing money, then the actors aren't going to get anything. This is of money made. So that's number one, is that this does not seem like that absurd of an ask to me. They're asking for parts of profits, which, considering the actors are the ones that a lot of people tune into shows for, is not an unusual request, or is not an absurd request, I don't think. But unfortunately for the actors, the producers got their word out first and basically said that the guild is being insane and we can't negotiate with terrorists. That's basically what it said. So their actual statement was, after meaningful conversations, it is clear that the gap between the AMPTP and SAG-AFTRA is too great and conversations are no longer moving us in a productive direction. So unfortunately, again, for the actors, it made them look bad because the studios got their word out first. And then not only that, but the response from SAG-AFTRA and Fran Drescher, who is the president and who is leading the negotiating committee, made them look not great either, because the response was, they're bullying us. Literally said that they are enforcing bullying tactics. So Fran Drescher said that AMPTP is using bully tactics and the same failed strategy they tried to inflict on the WGA in order to cripple the deliberations. And the fact that it keeps getting further and further and further apart, rather than, you know, like the writers have a deal and the studios basically said, you know, we offered you the same thing we offered the writers and you said no, this is now on you. So again, it's making the actors look bad. And now that the breakdowns have happened, I'm on the side of the actors. I don't think what the actors are asking for is in any way unproductive, to use the producers' words. I don't think it's unproductive. I think it's reasonable. Because again, without the actors, you have no product. And without actors, you typically don't have audiences. Like, you know, how many times do you watch a TV show where you don't recognize a single person in it? It's rare. I mean, we'll talk about Hallmark Countdown to Christmas coming up, but that's the only instance I can think of. Either that or like a really famous intellectual property. Like, the other thing I'm gonna talk about this week is Goosebumps. I would have watched that regardless of who's in it. But people who maybe don't care about something like a Goosebumps, if they see an actor they know like Justin Long, then they may be more apt to watch that adaptation. So like, unless it's a really famous intellectual property or like something like holiday programming or something where there's like an outside interest, people watch things because of actors. Do you know what I mean? Or directors or writers, like we follow people whose work we enjoy. And if that's the case, then you do need, these people are lining your pockets as producers. You need to be satisfying their needs and their demands. And the producers aren't, but again, I think the actors look, the SAG-AFTRA looks really bad in this situation because they didn't put something out right away and the response is to be like, but you're bullying us. And that just makes a lot of people see you as, I don't know, like glomming onto a buzzword of the moment or like victimizing yourself. And I don't know how well it's going to end for them. So it was gross but smart of the producers to do that, to get their word out first and then to also force the actors' hands. And that's where we're at. Again, I'm on the side of the actors, but unfortunately in this particular case, I think that the producers, in the court of public opinion, may have given themselves the upper hand. So basically, they are not talking anymore. Usually, they're talking one or two days a week. And then when this broke down on the 92nd or 91st, I forget which day of the strike, they suspended their talk. So I don't know when they're going to resume negotiations. So we may have a bunch of scripts ready to film very soon and no one to be in them. So that's what you have to look forward to. And also this week, just yesterday on Sunday, Suzanne Summers from Three's Company and Step by Step passed away one day before her 77th birthday at her home in Palm Springs. Now, Suzanne Summers is a very controversial figure. She had a like lifestyle fitness. I'm pretty sure she was the Thighmaster person. I didn't look that up when I was researching, quote unquote, researching her death, but if not, she at least promoted it. So, and then she also had like a lifestyle fitness brand and like books and stuff like that. But she also was a controversial figure later in her life. So when she was on Three's Company, she was one of the breakout stars. It was her, John Ritter, and Joyce DeWitt. And she was like played against type of this like dumb blonde. And she was very good on the show, very funny. She played Chrissy Snow. And after season 4, I think it was, she wanted to renegotiate her, speaking of negotiations, she wanted to renegotiate her contract to up her pay. So she wanted to be paid, she was being paid $30,000 an episode in 1980. So this is after season 4 going into season 5. She's being paid $30,000 an episode. John Ritter, who is the male lead, but still only one, like it's called Three's Company, not this guy and these two girls. It's called Three's Company. So the three of them are co-leads. He is getting paid $150,000 per episode. And Suzanne Summers wanted to be paid equally. And ABC said, no, we'll give you $35,000 an episode. So instead, she finished the 5th season, the last episodes of her contract, but because she was being paid so little, she was like, okay, then I want minimum screen time. So she was in 1 minute per episode. And then she was fired at the end of the season. So she did not get her raise, but she worked a lot less, which good for you. But then she was fired and she sued ABC for $2 million. She did not win. And she just got paid $30,000 because that's what she would have made for one episode that she wasn't paid for. And that sucks. That sucks. And good for her for sticking up for herself and equality and all of that. And that is so admirable. I mean, unfortunately for her, it was kind of proven that she was not necessary, quote unquote, so to speak, to the show because she left after 5 seasons and the show ran for another 3. It ran for 8 seasons. They replaced Chrissy with her sister Cindy at one point, and then they brought in somebody else who was unrelated to be the third in the Three's Company I forget who it was. I cannot believe, and I completely forgot or never realized that the show ran that long without Suzanne Somers. I've only ever watched, I guess, and or remember episodes that have Chrissy in them. So I didn't realize that there were four full seasons without Suzanne Somers. Three full seasons, 6, 7, and 8. Yeah, she was in season 5. But then her sister was like the main person in season 5. And she was kind of basically a guest because she was only in a minute an episode. But the fact that season 6, 7, and 8 aired without Chrissy is strange. I had literally no idea it lasted that long without her. And then later in her life, you know, she started becoming obsessed with like fitness and medicine, and she had a lot of controversial medical opinions. And by controversial, I mean conspiracy theorist, crackpot craziness. She wrote one book that was about, that advocated for using bioidentical hormone replacement therapy for anti-aging purposes. And BHRT is used to treat symptoms of menopause, but she was advocating for this new form that was called the Wiley Protocol. And I'm not going to pretend that I know what this is because I don't. But basically the entire medical community went against this one doctor or author or whoever the hell it is, T.S. Wiley, who said like this has no scientifical I talk goods. There's no scientific evidence this actually works and it could be dangerous and like we can't do it. So she wrote a whole book about how we should be doing that. Then she later was diagnosed with breast cancer, which eventually led to her death this weekend. And she then wrote a whole book about how we need to be using alternative treatments to cancer and not just like chemotherapy and medical treatments. We need to be doing other things. And that book was called Knockout. And she was criticized by everyone from doctors to like the American Cancer Society. It was like, this is literally no. Please stop telling people that if they have cancer that they shouldn't go to their doctors. That's not how this works. Then she had like all these other things like, she said that Sandy Hook, the shooting of elementary school children, the murders of dozens of children, was because the shooter was exposed to toxins in household cleaners, which is gross. It's just gross. Like, it's not saying that it didn't happen. Like, what's his face from InfoWars? I'm glad I don't remember his name. I don't want to know his name. But it's like one step below that. Like, oh, but we need to feel it's because he didn't eat right, so he killed a bunch of children. You're crazy. And then also later in her life, she became a Trump supporter and said how happy she was with him as president. And like, of course, she falls for conspiracy theories. Of course, she is fine and enjoys having Trump in office. He was a conspiracy theorist junkie himself, and nothing was ever his fault. Everything was the result of a conspiracy. So Suzanne Somers passed away this weekend at the age of 76, again, one day before her 77th birthday, and it's like a mixed bag because she's an OG. She was wonderful in Three's Company, an advocate for equality, but then also kind of lost the thread a little bit as she got older. Okay, I only have one thing I want to talk about this week, because there's a whole lot that's on TV, and I've talked about much of it already. But this past Friday, Hulu and Disney Plus premiered the first 5 episodes out of 10 of a new TV version of Goosebumps, which I mentioned. Now, if you are around my age, and I am 35, soon to be 36, God help me, the Goosebumps books, R.L. Stein, they are part of our DNA as millennials, okay? Millennials, and even some probably like, what are they called? Millennial Gen X cuspers, people who are like right on that line of being an older millennial or a young Gen X. R.L. Stein, Fear Street in particular. I've talked about the Fear Street movies that are on that Netflix made a couple years ago on the podcast. R.L. Stein is part of my DNA, and in particular, because I was the target reading age when Goosebumps started back in the 90s, he's part of who I am. I like everyone else my age, was obsessed with these books, the Goosebumps books, the original run only. I grew out of them before we got all these like thousands of spin-offs. It was the original and the Choose Your Own Adventure, which I'll get to. Those are the only ones I recognize as Goosebumps. Sorry about it. And it didn't matter if we were actually reading them or not. I actually read them. I was and still am a big reader. Just crossed 100 books read for this year, this week. But a lot of other kids that, you know, when we were in elementary school, it was that we wanted to collect them. They were big on like marketing things to kids to collect in the 90s, right? Like everyone collected Pogs and Pokemon and Beanie Babies and Goosebumps books. And like, I never played Pogs. I still have no idea how you play with Pogs, but we all collected them. We all wanted Slammers and shit, right? I never played the Pokemon card game, but I had hundreds of Pokemon cards and we traded them. You know what I'm saying? Same thing with Goosebumps, that a lot of kids didn't necessarily read them so much as we just wanted to have them, and we liked the covers and we liked the titles and the taglines that were on the covers, all that good shit. But like, we carried these books with us everywhere. When the Scholastic Book Fair came around, fucking forget it. Bedlam. So the first book came out in July of 92, and I started kindergarten in 93, the fall of 93. So like right around the time that book 3 was being published, we were having a Scholastic Book Fair, and it had like the raised cover with the bumps on the title. So like you could feel the bumps on the Goosebumps, and we thought that was the cleverest shit ever, because it really was. Like, I mean, now every book cover has raised foil embossed printing on it. Like, not back then. No. That was what made these books special. That, the bright colors, the crazy titles, the cool artwork, that they were short, the type was big. You could, even as a kid, I used to read them all in like one or two sittings. And now you could probably fly through them in like a half hour, 45 minutes. But we coveted these fucking books. Like, oh God, we wanted them so bad. I will never forget some of these books. They have stuck with me. Like, and most of those really popular, really famous books were then turned into a 1990s television show. And I can't remember where it aired. I can't remember if it was like Disney or Nickelodeon or both. I don't remember. But they turned a lot of those books into like an anthology series of TV episodes. And like, there were one or two parts, and they were based on one book each. And the one that everyone remembers of the TV show is The Haunted Mask, because that was also the first one to release on VHS. Which, again, if you didn't watch something in the 90s when it aired on TV, how you found it was you hoped it was on VHS and you saw it like at Sam Goody or The Wall or like Best Buy or something, right? Like, that is how we had to watch things in the 90s. So these books got really big. 92, 93, 94, they're enormous. The show starts in 95, and we're all watching, you know, The Haunted Mask, about this kid who gets a Halloween mask and it like turns her in, you know, like bad. She gets evil by putting on this Halloween mask when she goes trick-or-treating. And now, looking back, these books were not, like, they scared some kids, I feel like, but they were not actually scary. They were campy and silly, and some of them were scary. Like, don't get me wrong. If you were scared by these, that's, you're not, you know, a little wuss or anything. Like, they were meant to scare kids, but they did it. R.L. Stein did it in a very approachable, silly, cartoony kind of way. Like, for example, the Night of the Living Dummy, which is Slappy, the dummy that is ubiquitous with Goosebumps, has become like, you know, the mascot of Goosebumps. That I didn't think was an inherently scary story, especially because, you know, we had like Toy Story coming out later about like living toys. And like, the dummy didn't do anything, Slappy didn't do anything that out of control in the first book. I don't think, from what I remember, he was just like playing practical jokes, I think. Like, it wasn't like he was going around killing people, but the whole idea of a dummy, a ventriloquist dummy coming to life, was scary to kids because ventriloquist dummies themselves were creepy and weird, right? You know, like, that's what made these creepy and scary. Like, Stay Out of the Basement is one of the iconic covers with the plant hand reaching around the door. that's a purely silly book, right? Like, it's about like a mad scientist who's doing plant tests in his basement and becomes a plant creature, you know? So like, that wasn't scary so much as it was like silly and weird. So some of them, but then there are others that were meant to be scary. My all-time favorite was One Day at Horrorland, where like monsters run a theme park and they get trapped there after dark. And like, that one was scary to me, but also fun because it was like an adrenaline rush. And that's how, what these books were, that they oscillated between being scary, being campy, being funny, being just like weird, you know. Deep Trouble is another one I think we all remember, of like the hammerhead shark was on the cover, and that was about mermaids. So that one wasn't funny or wasn't scary. The Piano Lessons Can Be Murder was about someone who got their like hands cut off to play piano, and like the cover was creepy because it was like it was just a hand not attached to anything playing a piano. So sometimes I feel like the covers were scarier than the stories themselves, and a lot of kids would never know that because, like I said, they didn't actually read the books. All this a long way to say, the original TV series, which is being rebooted, quote-unquote, as this new series, was much more silly and campy and kind of like very much in the vein of the Nickelodeon shows at the time, where like the acting was bad and they had like goofy kind of like synthesized music in the background, and the effects weren't great because it's like, oh, this is a kid show. We're not going to spend real money on it. We're just going to make a ton of money off of it. And like, for my money, was just a really cheap knockoff, not as good version of Are You Afraid of the Dark, which to this day, I can't watch some, like, I would never, not that I can't, but I would never go back and watch some episodes of Are You Afraid of the Dark because they scarred me as a child. One of the ones being where the vampire comes out of the movie screen. Would never go back and watch that one because I remember how traumatized I was as a kid watching it. I literally had nightmares as a child. That was never the case with Goosebumps, either the books or the TV series. But this was, I should look up the number of books as I'm talking, but there were just so many books in that original run. And again, because it was that sweet spot of, they were all published while I was in like kindergarten, first, second, third grade, and the reading level was basically a reading level 2 or 3, I think, or maybe I was just an advanced reader, or both, I don't know, but maybe that's why the kids my age never read them. Anyway, regardless, they were short, they were sweet. I read them until probably like fourth grade, when I graduated to like a higher reading level and I realized, oh, hey, I can be reading like Fear Street or whatever the hell else. I mean, I was reading fucking Danielle Steele novels when I was in fourth and fifth grade because my grandmother liked them, and I would go to her house and just pick them up and read them. Like, literally, I was like 8 years old reading Message from Nam, not by Danielle Steele. Not appropriate. Regardless. Like, because it was, these books were all published in that sweet spot of when, like, I was in elementary school and of this target audience, we read fucking all of them, right? I'm gonna look. So there were 62 books in the original run, and I think I had or read all of them at some point. Maybe not. No, the last one that was published was Monster Blood 4, and I forget everything about Monster Blood, so maybe I didn't read that one. But I remember there was a late one that was about like eggs that were aliens, and a bunch of kids, like, they do an egg hunt but don't realize that some of the eggs they find are actually little aliens. That one was Egg Monsters from Mars. There it is. That one was silly as shit. That one was not scary. And I think that was around the time, that was book 42 out of 64. Okay, April 96. That was one where I kind of started to be like, oh, maybe I'm a little too old for these. But then, you know, they would catch me with like, you know, that they would do like a sequel to one that I loved, like a Say Cheese and Die Again or something, or another slappy book. Not the point. We're talking about the TV show. The TV show graduates like the campy, silly, cartoony feel of the original books and the original TV show and tries to make it into something more modern. And I think it succeeds on a lot of levels, not all, but it turns into like a Riverdale kind of show or a Pretty Little Liars. Like, there was a Pretty Little Liars spinoff that lasted one season. I watched maybe half of it, called Ravenswood. And it was about Caleb, one of the characters who went to this other town nearby where like supernatural shit happened. It's kind of in that vein. It feels very much like that show. Like, it has Pretty Little Liars, but make it supernatural. supernatural, which is what Ravenswood tried to do. So it's very that. It's very Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, very Riverdale, very like Stranger Things almost, where they're trying to do that. It's like, it feels like a CW show, but with higher production values. Like it's a group of teenagers who go to high school now, and then all their parents, and they're all related somehow. So it's like, how did what the parents did to this kid in 93, great callback to when these books started, affect what their kids are going through now. So that also, I really enjoy that they're tying like this group of people who are not my age. They're like 10 years older. But again, like from the past, around the times of the original books being published, like now, that they're bridging that gap of like, we know that like LOL, wink, wink, we're calling back to 30 years ago when these books were a thing versus now where we're trying to bridge that gap. I think that's fun. But so they tried, it's darker, right? And it's not an anthology. It's serialized. So everything is building upon each episode before it, but it's still introducing elements of individual books. Each episode is named after a classic book from the original series. I think it's so much fun. I watched all of it, all five episodes on the first day, and then the next five are coming out one a week on Fridays on both Hulu and Disney Plus. So the group that we're following are Isaiah, who is black, and he is the quarterback of the football team. Margot, who is his friend and neighbor, and they like secretly kind of like each other, but won't admit it because they've been friends forever. James, who is Isaiah's best friend, is gay and very rich. Isabella, who is like invisible at school, and while it's not part of the books, a great callback again to one of those original Goosebumps books, something about like how to let's get invisible. There it is. So like, even though she's not literally invisible, still a fun callback. And then she lashes out at school by becoming a troll and trolling everyone online. Then we also have Lucas, whose father was an extreme, like an X Games type of person, and died, and he's now kind of going through it. Yeah, and that's the group. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, so that's the group. And then also we follow a lot of their parents, one of whom is Rob Hubel, who you'll recognize from the confetti GIF, or GIF, however you say it. He was on Children's Hospital and a bunch of other stuff. He is Margot's dad. He's a guidance counselor at the high school. Rachel Harris, who is wonderful. You also recognize her as like that woman from That Thing. She's on Lucifer and some other stuff. She is Lucas's mom, who had some conspiracy theories, some like supernatural theories, what would happen way back. Leonard Roberts is Isaiah's dad. And then, you know, like some other adults as well. So like the adults were all a group in high school, and then all the kids are all a group now, and like the connection there, they are all connected by this kid Howard Biddle, who we see in the first scene of the series was kind of a loner in a lot of ways. He died in a fire, in an explosion when they were all in high school. And then how that is tied to the group from the past and the group from the present is kind of like the supernatural tie is the storyline that the series follows. So the kids now are trying to like connect the dots of what their parents did and how, you know, Howard Biddle is like haunting them now. And how he is haunting them is that he possesses the new English teacher who inherits and then moves into Harold Biddle's old house, and he's played by Justin Long. So there's our connection. And now we like spend each episode kind of getting an introduction to each of these five teen characters. I thought the first episode was kind of boring for the first half, and I was like, oh, I'm probably not going to make it through all of these episodes. But it really takes off about halfway through when they start to introduce the original Goosebumps books elements. And the title of the first episode is Say Cheese and Die. So if you know the original book, that was about a haunted camera that took pictures of things that hadn't happened but were bad and like made those things happen. And that's what we get here, that Isaiah, they break into the old Biddle house and throw a Halloween party, not realizing that the new English teacher has moved in. And each one of them kind of, they go into the basement where Harold Biddle died, and they all kind of interact with something strange. And the one that Isaiah, who is the focus of the first episode, interacts with is a Polaroid camera that takes a picture of, oh God, which one is it? Margot having an allergic reaction, which she later does, and he saves her with her EpiPen. And his girlfriend, Allison, I forget what hers is, that she's like lost in the woods or something. And then he also takes a picture, somebody takes a picture of him, and it shows him lying on the football field with a broken arm. And then later that, when they're playing the football game, he sees these like visions of Harold Biddle on fire. And he has a moment where, from the outside looking in, it looks like he's having a psychotic break, and he ends up injuring himself and breaking his arm, just like in the photo from the camera. But Nora, Lucas's mom, Rachel Harris, sees this and is like, oh shit, Harold Biddle's back. So we get that connection immediately. And that's how, then the first episode ends with Harold possessing the new English teacher, Mr. Brad. So it was much darker. Like that first episode, not a lot of camp, not a lot of comedy, kind of straight, like dark, not really scary, but like a thriller in a lot of ways, kind of uneasy, very darkly lit and shot, because again, it is a modern horror, quote unquote, TV show. And that's what we do now. We put things in the dark and like make people squint at their screens to try and see them. Yeah. But then, like, you know, we start to, the second episode, pure horror. It's the haunted mask episode. And Isabella, the girl who's overlooked, finds this mask, puts it on. She literally turns into a demon and attacks people. So that's definitely taking that kind of goofy concept of the haunted mask and the silliness that we all remember of the episodes of the original TV show and kind of really making it Riverdale-esque and flipping it and going really dark and making her kind of like a literal monster, like a demon looking thing. Then we also get the Cuckoo Clock of Doom. Then this one kind of goes into campy, silly territory. So just like the books, where some are super dumb and meant to be campy and comedic more than they are scary, that's exactly how the TV show is. So we go from scary haunted mask episode 2 to episode 3 being the Cuckoo Clock of Doom, where every time James like hits his head on the cuckoo clock at the house, and then he enters a time loop, and every time he's in the time loop, he creates a duplicate of himself, which can be destroyed by hitting them with an object, and they explode into green or greenish yellow slime. So that's a little silly. And then the fourth episode is based on Go Eat Worms, again, an iconic one from when we were kids. Everyone had this book. Everyone loved that title with all the wiggly, squiggly worms. And this was one that a lot of kids actually read, I feel like. Maybe there was an episode of the show that everyone watched. I don't remember. Where, if I'm remembering correctly, the kid turns into a worm. Maybe I'm misremembering that. In this one, that's not what happens. But like, this is the most clear example, episode 4, of the camp next to the scary, where this kid eats these worms, becomes very unlike himself, and then vomits them all up. And then they kind of turn into this big, giant, super worm creature thing that chases him. And it's creepy because of the way that the creature that it becomes moves and chases him. And it's like, meant to be, there's like a big action sequence, but also then you realize these are a bunch of worms. they're just worms. Like worms, I feel like, are meant, kids find them gross and kind of scary, like you play with them when you're a kid, but also they're very weirdly alien and foreign. And I mean, eating worms is something a lot of kids just do because they're curious. So then taking that idea and making Go Eat Worms, the book, was very clever of R.L. Stine. I don't know if that's a thing that, like, obviously older teens and audiences don't really do that. So that's a little bit of a weird one to integrate into this TV show, I think. But they're really hitting on the classic books. And the last episode that was released was episode 5, which is based on not one single book, but based on the idea of the spinoff series, Give Yourself Goosebumps, where it's like a choose your own adventure, because those were also big in the 90s. We loved those. And the titles were or the series was called Give Yourself Goosebumps, but then the tagline for all of them was Reader Beware, you pick the scare or you create the scare or something. So the fifth episode is called Reader Beware, and it's based on this idea of a book where there's multiple different endings and you get to watch them kind of play out. And that is, whose episode is that? Margot, I want to say. I think it's Margot's episode. So yeah, and then it kind of ends on a cliffhanger, which was very smart, and we start to get more information about the older, the parents, and how they are tied into everything, and I thought it was really fun. It is not highbrow, it is not a remake or of the 90s TV show, it is not a remake of the books, it is a true adaptation. It is taking some of the storylines, it is taking some of these like iconic titles and images from our childhood and modernizing them. And I think it does that in a really fun, cool kind of way. And I sped through these. I watched all of them in one sitting on a Saturday. It was like rainy and gross out, and I was wrapped the whole, except for the first like 20 minutes of the first episode, like I said, I was in it. I had a lot of fun watching these. And looking at the titles that are coming up, Slappy is coming. And like I said, my favorite book is the Horrorland book with the theme park. That's the title of the finale, is Welcome to Horrorland. So I am looking forward to what they are doing with the rest of these episodes. I think it's a great Halloween thing because it's not too scary, but it's also not too childish. So if you're looking for something that's very atmospheric and kind of weird and nostalgic, but not mostly funny like Hocus Pocus and its sequel, or not mostly scary like a horror movie like the slashers that are real popular right about now, this hits that sweet spot of kind of meeting in the middle, that it's both horror and comedy, but it's not like silly comedy. It's like weird comedy. I don't know how to explain it. Like, it's not horror comedy in the way that the Chucky series is horror comedy. It's horror comedy in that it's like campy. Like, it takes itself seriously. Everything that happens on the show happens as if it's really happening. And the actors take it seriously. And the scripts take it seriously. But it's also presented and filmed in a way that makes it obvious to us that they're nodding to how campy the books and some of these stories are. Like, you can't do the Cuckoo Clock of Doom where people are exploding into goo and take it 100% seriously. Like, there are comedic elements to that, and it really does touch on how odd and campy it is, but the actors are never on screen like, oh wow, that was really weird. Huh. You know, like they're taking it seriously as if like, holy shit, he just exploded. Yeah. But like I said, I'm having fun. I am having fun with this, and that's all I'm asking for, because not only are the pickin' slim right about now, but I have been burned by a lot of nostalgia properties, especially of late. So I like when they do something interesting and different. And that's what this version of Goosebumps is doing, I think. It's not going to be for everyone. I saw some reviews already are like, but I thought this was a remake of the 90s TV show. And it's not. Why is the 90s theme not there? Which, if you remember, was the G from the Goosebumps, a shadow of it just like floating around a town. Like, there's a dog just sunning itself on the porch at one point, and then the G just like floats across his fur. It's very silly, and it's, when you hear them, I'm not going to try and sing it for you, but when you hear the music, it'll take you back to your childhood. Like, people want that in there, but it doesn't fit. It's not what they're doing. They're not doing the 90s stuff. Like, the reason that I feel like a lot of this stuff we got away with in the 90s is because the 90s were a weird ass decade. They were a wonderful decade, the last great decade. Ask anybody who is over the age of 18. The 90s were the last great decade. But it was weird. Like, you think that that's when Pokemon came, Goosebumps, like all of this weird Beanie Babies. Like, what the fuck were we doing in the 90s? You know how we had like hypercolor t-shirts and moon shoes? The fuck were we doing in the, what were we thinking in the 90s? It was a wild time. And like, you could not write this Goosebumps, the original Goosebumps series, in 2023. kids are too savvy. They have the internet now. Like, they've already, by the time they're six, they've already seen some shit. You know what I mean? They're not going to want to be watching or reading something that's, like, scary can be. They're just not going to. And so that was very 90s. So they can't do that now. They can't make this series the way they would have made it in the 90s. They can't just translate those books to now. It would look absolutely insane. They would need to make it for literal children. But then those kids wouldn't like it. Do you know what I'm saying? It's that weird area. So instead, let's make something for the age range that enjoyed Goosebumps as a kid and maybe now wants to revisit it. And that's what this is. So if you are a millennial, if you ever read a Goosebumps book, give this a shot. It's much less absurd than the two movies that came out in the last, like, what, 10 years, I guess? 8 years, however long it's been, the Jack Black one and the other one. Like, it's not as silly and cartoony as those. It's much more serious and it's much darker. And so far, 5 episodes in, we're halfway there. I think it's pretty much successful and I'm excited to see what happens. So first 5 episodes streaming now on Hulu and Disney Plus, and then new episodes are releasing once a week on Fridays until the finale on November 17th. Okay, so for my recommendations for the next few weeks, what I'm going to be doing instead of recommending something that I've already watched is Countdown to Christmas starts this Friday, October 20th. And I know it's too early for a lot of you. I don't care. It is not too early for me. Once Hallmark says it's Christmas to me. So what I'm going to do, instead of, like, in the past couple of years, I've recommended a movie I've already watched that I enjoyed the most that weekend, but I literally talked to two or three people who listen to this, one of whom is not one of my friends. So hi. And they're like, oh, I missed that. But then I'm trying to catch up and, like, it's hard to find it because they're on Peacock only for, like, 3 days. So by the time the episode releases on Monday, if I've recommended the Friday movie, it's gone by the time they try to look for it Tuesday. So I'm going to recommend a movie coming up based on how interesting I think it sounds, or how good I think it sounds, based on the cast, the description, and the poster. So if you want to follow along, I love and recommend the Hallmark Movie Channel app. It has a list of all the movies coming up. It has, you know, like, what's currently airing, and you check them off as you watch them. But you can also add movies that you want to watch to your Google or Apple calendar. So if there's a movie coming up that you're like, oh, that sounds stupid, I want to watch that, you go into the app and find it and then click on the little button that says want to watch, and it will ask if you want to add it to your calendar. And if you do, it'll connect to the calendar on your phone and put it in your calendar. So you'll know to either watch it, record it, or get it on Peacock before it goes away. So for the first weekend, we're getting a Friday, a Saturday, and a Sunday movie. Going forward, we're getting a Thursday movie as well on the Movies and Mysteries channel, which is Hallmark's other channel. This first week, we're easing in with three movies. And the three movies are on Friday, first up, the premiere, the first movie of Countdown to Christmas, which is never all that great, I'm going to be honest. It's usually one that's like, oh, that was okay. I'm kind of in the Christmas spirit, but you can tell they're saving the big guns for later. It's called Checking It Twice. A journeyman hockey player falls for a real estate agent in a career crisis when he's traded to her hometown and moves into the cottage in her hockey-loving family's backyard. Now, you'll notice the word Christmas was not said once in this description, which worries me. That, to me, says this was not a Christmas movie. This was a winter movie that they are repurposing because of the strike or whatever. And it stars Kim Mitula, who was in one of the best ones from last year, Ghosts of Christmas Always, and Kevin McGarry, who has also been in a bunch of these and is on When Calls the Heart. The Saturday movie is called Where Are You, Christmas? When Addie wishes for a year without Christmas, she wakes up in a world of black and white. She must work together with the town mechanic to restore Christmas. Now, okay. First of all, this sounds really fun, right? That we're doing the juxtaposition of black and white and color, like a very Pleasantville. Lindsay Fonseca is the lead alongside Michael Rady, who I love both of them. Michael Rady has been in a bunch of these, including one of my favorites from a couple years ago, A Turtle Dove Christmas, I think it was called. It was called Two Turtle Doves. And it was about grief and a single father trying to do a first Christmas with his daughter after her mother died. Very, very sad, emotional, but Very hopeful movie. I loved that one. He also was on Melrose Place remake on the CW, which I loved. And then Lindsay Fonseca was on the Nikita remake on the CW, which I also really liked. And she was in a really good one either last year or the year before I recommended, called Next Stop Christmas. And it was like a time traveling train. And Christopher Lloyd was in that. So the cast alone, I'm into. The black and white and the color, I'm into. Why the fuck is she working with a mechanic? What? Whatever. Anyway, that one sounds fun. And then finally on Sunday, we're getting Under the Christmas Sky. Kat is an esteemed astrophysicist who is scheduled for her first trip into space next year until an accident grounds her. And then as she comes to terms with this accident, she has to set up a Christmas exhibit at the planetarium with this other dude. Okay, now this stars Ryan Pavey, who everyone at Hallmark Channel loves. I don't like him. He is always stone-faced, monotone to me. I liked him in one movie, but it was because it was a good movie, not because he was good. And that was Christmas at the Plaza, I want to say it's called. It was the one at the Plaza Hotel, and it was filmed at the Plaza Hotel. It was beautiful. But I don't really like him. And Jessica Parker Kennedy, who I also don't really like. She was on The Flash. She was the Flash's daughter on The Flash. Don't really love her either. And astrophysicist? Christmas? Planetarium? What the fuck? Already I'm like, these three are weird. They sound like we're going to plan a thing at Christmas. But the twist is, she's an astrophysicist. The twist is, she's in black and white. The twist is, he's a hockey player. You know what I mean? Like, they don't sound all that interesting. But the one I'm most looking forward to, my recommendation to see how it plays out, is going to be Where Are You, Christmas? The black and white Pleasantville sounding one. So that one is on Saturday at 8 o'clock. Saturday, October 21st. Set your DVR. Make sure that you have your Peacock subscription, because they only are on for 3 days after airing. So it'll go up on Saturday and it'll be there, or it'll go up on Sunday. It'll be there Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and that's it. So if you don't watch it Sunday, Monday, Tuesday on Peacock, you're SOL. And then you got to either find it airing and record it, or you got to wait for it to be on. The Hallmark app, again, is really good for that, because if you miss a movie and you forget to record it or whatever, it'll show you. You click on that movie, it'll show you when the next time that movie is on. And now my goal with this is to get all of you as addicted to Countdown to Christmas as I am, if you are not already. So we need everyone to get on board. This is what we're doing, okay? And sometimes I'm going to be recommending ones that I think sound insane, kind of like I'm doing this week. Other weeks, I'm going to be recommending ones that I think sound actually decent, or that I think will be good, or that have great casts, or whatever. So join me on this psychotic little ride. Download the app. Get yourself in the Christmas boat. Again, I know that this is like fully 11 days before Halloween. They're starting this year, but that's just because of the way the holidays fall. Christmas Eve is on a Sunday, which means the last day that they can air a new movie in December is the 17th. And that's like 4 or 5 days earlier than usual. Like, I think last year it was like the 21st, I think. There was 1 year where like the 21st, they were still airing new movies. So they had to start earlier. I don't make the rules. It's just the way that it is. And like I said, I don't care. If Hallmark tells me it's Christmas, it's Christmas. So get on board with that. Normalize doing things that bring you joy. I think I said this on the podcast before. If Christmas brings you joy, start celebrating Christmas whenever the fuck you want. And screw everyone who's like, it's too early. Halloween is first. Thanksgiving is first. Need I remind you that Thanksgiving is a colonial holiday and we do not need to be celebrating it. So fuck that. Celebrate Christmas whenever you want. If you're a Halloween person, you want to start decorating your house with 12-foot skeletons and cotton spiderwebs in July, fucking do it. I don't care. I'm not going to yuck your yum. I hate Halloween, but I'm not going to go around and be like, ew, these decorations are ugly. You're stupid for liking Halloween. 4th of July comes first. Labor Day comes first. Yom Kippur comes first. No, I'm not going to do that. Do whatever the fuck you want. Do what makes you happy. And Christmas movies on Hallmark Channel make me happy. So please join me on the path to happiness this season on Fake TV Critic. All right, that's it for me this week, guys. I'll see you next week with more. What the hell is my outro? I'll be back next week with more news, more reviews, more analyses, and more recommendations for Countdown to Christmas. Have a good week, everyone.